Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And we're back with another theory podcast. Woo!
Woo! Continuing our coag theory.
Yeah.
So you want to give us a
last time we talked about the cascade, so secondary hemostasis. We did that, and we did the regulatory proteins, so the control proteins like antithrombin and such.
Yeah.
So I think we'll do a quick review of that today, and then we'll keep going on from there.
Yeah.
I guess
I think one of the hardest parts of COAG is the memorization part of it. So we hope to kind of like, while we review, maybe give you a couple of tools.
Yeah, so the biggest thing is writing it out. Just write it out over and over. It'll be really helpful. But why don't we take our listeners to Walmart?
Stay with us here.
No, we're not really going to Walmart, but
yeah,
a friend of ours told us this easy way to memorize the COAG cascade. And it's why go to Walmart and pay $12 for a shirt when you can pay $11.98.
And I still use this, so I forget the whole story, but the intrinsic was always the most difficult for me, and this, like, just I was like, okay, there it is, it's done. Yeah. So why buy for 12 when you can get for $11.98? So the why creates that fork between the intrinsic, extrinsic to the common pathway. And then 12, 11, 9, 8. So if we remember, 9 and 8 form our intrinsic tenase. So yeah, this is just really cool. It's an elegant, funny way. We've all been to Walmart. We all know they're associated with, like, saving a couple, 2 cents in this case, I guess.
Yes. So why pay $12 when you can pay $11.98? Now, once you actually go to the cash register to pay, right, you're going to pay with maybe a 10 or a 5, or if you have really old money, maybe you have a $2 bill. Or a $1 bill. So you could use tens, fives, twos, or ones if you wanted to pay for your shirt.
And then 10 and 5, we remember, right, are our prothrombinase. Yeah. Factor 2, and, you know, the
it's prothrombin and then fibrinogen.
I think a little bit more intuitively, you remember 2 and 1, like prothrombin and fibrinogen. I think most folks, right, will remember that. I hope so. That's just, if you got, and then the 10 and the fives. Yeah.
Well, and
this
if
is just
not
a really
now,
elegant.
And if not now, you're going to be like, who used $2 bills? Everyone's going to remember $2 bills.
They're quite uncommon. But it's there. There might even be some folks who are like, what is a $2 bill?
Oh, are we that old, Dave?
I think so. I think so.
Oh my goodness. All right. And then the other one is just 7. I don't remember a snazzy way to remember 7.
Yeah. So it's not perfect, but for me, intrinsic and then getting to the common, the prothrombinase, this is very useful. Yeah.
Yep. So just a nice, easy way to help everybody memorize a quick way. I mean, of course, you still have to remember, you know, 11 is activated, 9 is activated, 8 has to be activated to participate. There's all of that to memorize, but as long as you know that, and then you know that all these factors are in these orders.
Yeah. And it leaves out 13, the stabilizing factor and stuff too. It's not perfect, but this will get you the bones of the COAG cascade. So practice our Walmart. We're not endorsing or but you know, but it works. Yeah, I guess you could use, like, what, Target or one of the competitors, whatever.
Use
you
any store that you go and buy shirts from, I guess.
Who cares? So that's good. So
So
I think that's
that's
a big challenge for people with coag, right? I don't think we have any snazzy tricks for our control proteins, right? But
No. No, like I said, last episode is antithrombin. I always remember that it's 2, 9, 10, 11, 12.
yeah. And that's just memorization, folks. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about antithrombin, right?
Yeah. So
Antithrombin, that should be straightforward.
yeah,
But then you
two.
could always think antithrombin 9, 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
Because two is inherently built into that. So if you memorize like that sort of thing, that makes it easier. I guess the other thing that folks are going to need to memorize are the vitamin K dependent factors.
Yeah, very important. So vitamin K dependent factors are important for a few different reasons. We have therapies that are vitamin K antagonists in particular. So knowing how that drug, warfarin, what's Coumadin, I'm trying to think of the other names. Also, it could be that patients have nutritional deficiencies because of other systemic issues, chronic alcoholism or just a general poor diet can lead to a vitamin K deficiency. Melissa, you brought up earlier, antibiotics can cause havoc on the gut biome, which can influence vitamin K absorption and things like that. So vitamin K deficiency is like a real thing. So it can be kind of induced by medications and can be encountered just in the wild, sort of. So knowing what factors will be how do we say this? Because you, th so I struggle with this, Melissa. So this is, I'm getting your opinion and we're just having discussion. Do you say that you're deficient in the factors, or are you just deficient in the factors that actually work, right?
Yeah.
Like,
Yes. So you have a decreased synthesis of your coag, basically the zymogens that you should be activating to use in coag. Your zymogens are decreased. You can synthesize these factors, but you can't make them usable for coag without vitamin K.
So
So
I
I
always struggle
guess,
with how to like
yeah.
say this to students, because at some point you can have a functional definition
Right.
that's not accurate. But yeah.
Well, so in like the special coag lab, we usually say that you are deficient of your vitamin K dependent factors, or you have a decrease of your vitamin K dependent factor. So we do call it that, even though you can synthesize the factor before vitamin K influences it, but that you can't actually make the coag active zymogen. Coag
So,
active zymogen sounds weird together, but
So yeah, and maybe I'm being a little, maybe it'd be better if we employ the use of your cartoons.
Yes.
So our
So,
vitamin K dependent factors,
yep.
right? So 2, 7, 9, 10. This is another one that you just got to kind of hammer it in your head. I don't have a good way for this. I
And
honestly
then
don't.
there's protein C. And protein
Yeah.
S. There's also protein Z, but we don't really talk about protein Z very much. So I
And
don't,
protein
I
Z is so has like such a small activity, right? That it's like,
There's a, so with this, I also don't have a very good way of memorizing the vitamin K dependent factors, although I did have a group of students that made it into a march and they memorized it to a marching like beats. They would just march, like literally march, and just go 2, 7, 9, 10, protein C and protein S. It worked for that class. So
This is one of the magical things about teaching is you just get these groups of people sometimes that take on their own character, and
yes.
that's funny.
So that's how they memorized it. It was very entertaining for me, to say the least.
The other thing that works for my brain, and it's not a complete thing, but like 2 plus 7 equals 9, it doesn't do anything for 10, unfortunately, but
Or protein C or S, but
or protein C or S. But yeah. And honestly, protein C or protein S, I actually remember a bit because of the physiological. So like on a therapeutic dosing of Warfare. I'm going place I probably shouldn't go. But if someone has to take Coumadin, they usually do something with a heparin bridging in the therapy transition, where when they start the Coumadin therapy, they simultaneously use heparin. And that's because you'll lose the anticoagulant effect of protein C and protein S before you use the procoagulant effect of 279 and 10. So that kind of always kind of keeps it in my mind, even though I forgot. That's one of the ways that I kind of remember, hey, Coumadin affects both anticoagulation and procoagulation. But anyway, that's kind of more advanced hemostasis probably. But
That's more
anyway.
applicable.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
guess less examinable and more
Yeah. Yeah.
applicable.
Yeah. Yeah, so true, right? Because I'm never going to ask that test question ever, but in the real world.
Okay. So with our vitamin K dependent factors, we've talked a little bit of like we've kind of danced around vitamin K, what it does. So vitamin K, I think textbooks and your instructors will tell you that vitamin K is responsible for post-translation gamma carboxylation.
What does that mean, right?
Huh?
So
So when you hear it, like post-translational is just talking about translating the mRNA into your protein, essentially. So post-translation, that's all that means. It's nothing fancy or exciting. The gamma carboxylation is actually the process of m just moving a carboxy group on your gamma carbon. That's all it is. So let's draw out a glutamine. So we've got our one carboxy group here at the end, and we've got our gamma carbon. So we know this is our gamma. We've got our beta carbon, and then we've got our alpha carbon here.
we got to tap into our biochem a little bit, right?
Yep.
But it'll be worth it. I actually promise
But
it'll be worth it.
I mean, this is in some respects why coag is also chemistry.
Yeah,
Because you
100%.
have to deal with like the molecule, its relationship. When we're talking about cleaving, we're just talking about cutting off portions of your molecule, enzymatically removing portions of the molecule. So it's all just chemistry. And so essentially what you're doing is you're having an enzyme and vitamin K to add a carboxy group. That's all we're doing when we're going through gamma carboxylation. So we're taking this gamma carbon and we're adding another carboxy group to here. So I'll draw it out. Now let me start with the gamma carbon because the rest of it's, oh, I lied. I need my eraser.
I think so. While you draw that, I'll talk a little bit about my perspective as a student, and even I consider myself still a student, so I still have to study this material. Sometimes I can go longer and longer, it seems, the more time I spend with this over the years. But like studying and maintaining mastery is like an active thing. So I just want to tell everybody that straight away.
You
But
don't
one of
use
the
it, you
things.
lose it.
It's 100% true. And so one of the things that made this, so when I look at this, I'm like, why do I care, right? And I think there's a lot of reasons to care. And the textbook that we use, the drawing of it, actually includes also calcium here. And so I'm going to tell you why that's important. So one of the main ways we anticoagulate a specimen is using some form of calcium chelator. So EDTA is one of the classic heavy calcium chelators. And of course, sodium citrate is for coag, also chelates calcium. So if we can remove and occupy all the calcium in a sample, we can stop coag from happening. So why do we care about this discussion, right? The reason why vitamin K, this post-translational adding of the carboxyl group is so important is because you're changing the charge on the molecule. So by making it negative two, we now give it the opportunity for a positive two plus ion like calcium to interact with it. And remember, calcium is integral to coag, right? And so I think all of these pieces of the story make it more like sticky in my brain. So might not work for everybody, but kind of having this level of understanding can make it easier to memorize, at least, maybe for some folks.
Well, two things. One, yes, EDTA and sodium citrate both chelate calcium. But why don't we use EDTA for coag then, if they do the same thing?
Yeah, so I think of them as like they both yeah. So they both work in a similar fashion. With when it comes to EDTA, we like to say that it's an irreversible binder of calcium. So it is an extremely strong chelator. So just because it does something similar, it can do it on different orders of magnitude, right? So when I say
Yes.
orders of magnitude, we could be thousand million times more powerful in doing a particular action than another. So to our benefit, sodium citrate chelates calcium, but is reversible. So if you flood a sample with enough calcium, you can overwhelm the anticoagulant effect in a blue top, and that's very beneficial, right? So physiological levels of calcium, it'll chelate all that, no problem, right? But then when our reagent calcium hits the cuvette, it's overwhelmed, and that's good. So it's like a pause button for us, right? Whereas EDTA is just like, it's just a hungry, hungry hippo of
I love that.
calcium. Yeah.
That was a good explanation, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Nice
The
prompt.
other thing with this is, think back to the talk we did the last episode where we introduced the coag cascade, and we talked about the function of activated factor nine and the function of activated factor eight. And remember, I mentioned that factor eight activated's real function is to help kind of bridge the gap between activated factor nine and the phospholipids, which is another charged molecule. So we're trying to interact calcium, activated factor nine, rich activated factor nine, right? We're talking about this guy right here, a vitamin K dependent factor, and calcium. So we're trying to bridge all of them to interact with one another. And so that's in part why we have to have the vitamin K go through this gamma carboxylation. So gamma is just telling us we're adding it to the gamma carbon, right? Gamma carboxylation, gamma carbon. That's all it's saying. And the ixylation is just the process of adding a carboxy group onto that gamma carbon. That's literally all that fancy term means. But I know the terms gamma carboxylation can sometimes be scary.
Intimidating, and then it can also feel like, well, geez, why do I need to know that? And there is some nuance there as to at what level you need to understand it. But digging deeper can be more helpful. So the reason why we're talking about it at this level of detail is because, in my opinion, and perhaps in Melissa's opinion, it can actually make it easier to remember.
Yeah. I mean, if you know more than you need to know, right? If you learn it, you learn the info more than you need to know, then you're gonna forget the minute details unless you really know the minute details. But you're gonna be like, oh yeah, I remember what gamma carboxylation means. All we're doing is adding that carboxy group because we need to interact with the charges, right? So even if you don't remember, we're adding a carboxy group to this gamma carbon right here, and we're interacting with the calcium because, and it's going to interact with the phospholipid. But like, if you remember like the generic information, if you learn more details, you're going to remember the generic information a little bit more.
Yeah, you just get there easier. Yeah, comes back faster, all those good things. And then, like, there'll be other parts of your education that reference maybe some of these scary words in such ways that they're not as scary. You can kind of see, because Mother Nature has this, it tends to repeat itself.
It's all
You
the
see.
biochemical functions. That's
Yeah.
literally like if you took organic chemistry, which I'm sure you did, and you know organic chemistry, and if you like organic chemistry, then you'll remember, oh, I already know what gamma carboxylation is because orgo is all about like the spatial structure and the changes you're making to the alpha, the beta, the gamma, to whatever carbon it is. We're just employing that and kind of applying that knowledge here. So we're not teaching it to you in kind of that abstract spatial crap that Orgo teaches you.
Right. Orgo's a beast. Good luck to
Yes.
all our student listeners. All
So
right.
that's vitamin K.
Yeah.
I think we can kind of maybe mosey over to the cell-based model now.
Very good. So if you remember originally, we had talked a little bit about the cell-based model. We may have mentioned it. And then we taught you this non-cell-based model because so this first part of COAG is talking about it as to how it's going to happen in the cuvette. So you know, functionally running PT, PTTs, this helps you very much think about those assays, how these clot-based assays are going to work. And so if you have a protein deficiency, some kind of COAG factor deficiency, you can kind of say, oh, is it in the intrinsic, right? Is it in the common pathway? Is it in the extrinsic? Really helps with test interpretation. But on a practical level, what happens in the body, it's different than what's happening in the cuvette. So now we got to talk about that. And so I will say too, before we start, that learning this other model, this commonly taught model of COAG, left me with some questions, right? So like you may, as the viewer, have some questions like where the heck did factor VIII come from, right? So we told you that thrombin activates factor VIII, which it does. But like thrombin, prothrombin to thrombin, that happens late in the cascade. So as a student, this always like bugged me. And I memorized the thing I needed to memorize, and like I knew which p, but it didn't totally make sense until I started to look at the cell-based model. So hopefully now that perspective can be helpful for you folks. Now, granted, I don't know. So how much is this tested on the BOC, you think, Melissa? Maybe not at all.
When I teach COAG, I always teach the COAG cascade based model because it's the model that we really use in the lab. It's the in vitro model, so to speak. The in vivo model, which the more the cell-based model, I also teach it, but why don't we, so let's just go over the cell-based model and then we can kind of dance back to the cascade-based model and we can apply the cell-based model to the cascade-based model.
Do
Because
that.
that's really how I teach the cell-based model. I don't teach the cell-based model quite as the textbook does. I mean, we will just so that everybody can get an idea of what the cell-based model is. But yeah, so let's just cell-based. So when we say cell-based, we're talking about this being like the actual physiological method of what happens in vivo.
Get excited when I think about platelets.
Okay, off topic, but do you remember the platelet costume that I wore for Halloween one year?
I do remember the playlist costume.
I wore it to the university that I was teaching for, and I was just a nice resting platelet. But whenever I got aggravated, I would shoot silly string at people from my little spidey can on my wrist. It was fantastic. Anyway, back to platelets. Okay, so the cell-based model. With the cell-based model, there are only two stages. There's initiation, and then there's propagation. So, with these two phases, essentially, your initiation phase is where you're getting maybe like 3-ish% of all of your thrombin generated that you're going to use for the whole COAG cascade. Whereas propagation, you're getting most of your thrombin that you're going to utilize in really generating fibrinogen into fibrin and getting your clot formation. So then you may be thinking, well, what about this thrombin that's generated here? So essentially, what happens is, and remember, the cell-based model is really trying to tell you that this. Everything that we've taught you so far, the COAG cascade, platelet activation, adhesion, aggregation, it's all happening simultaneously. That's really what the cell-based model is trying to teach you. So even if you don't memorize the whole cell-based model, if you can recognize that the cell-based model through initiation and propagation, it's all happening simultaneously. Now, our brains don't really work that way, like when we're trying to memorize and think, which is why the coag cascade-based model is far superior. So, or at least for memorizing, for our purposes when we're thinking about it. But physiologically, what's actually happening, the cell-based model is more appropriate. So you damage your vasculature, you release tissue factor, right? And that's really one of the things that is going to drive the whole process. This
So,
extra
like most
vascular,
clots,
yes.
right? Like most normal physiological clotting, this is what happens. Intrinsic
Yes.
be damned, right? Like,
Yeah, I mean, and there are times where the intrinsic cascade can start the process, but normal physiological processes, it's usually the extrinsic pathway. It's usually tissue factor. And remember, tissue factor is not intravascular, it's extravascular. So you can secrete tissue factor. Well, you lose tissue factor when you damage the endothelium, right? You expose it intravascularly. And then when you're dealing with platelets, once they're activated, they're also excreting some form of thromboplastin or tissue factor. So, but when we're thinking about the initiation phase, it's starting because of extravascular tissue factor. So you've damaged the endothelium and you've exposed tissue factor. So tissue factor will bind with activated factor seven, or it'll activate factor seven.
And we have some activated factor seven just circulating around in our body, right? So it's just hanging out and
Yep. And so these two together are going to do their thing. They're going to activate factor 10, right? So we're going to get 10 to 10A. You're going to get 10A going to activate our thrombin. Our prothrombin into thrombin. Now remember, you're like, well, there's no activated factor five. So how are you doing that? Activated factor 10, just like when we talked about nine, right? So activated factor 10 can activate prothrombin on its own, but it's very, very slow and very inefficient. But you're going to activate some prothrombin into thrombin. And here, this about 3% thrombin generation that you're initially getting is really going to go off and activate factor five, factor 10, factor eight. It can hit up nine. And don't forget that this guy, these right here, they're also going to activate factor nine. So you're getting some nine being activated by this guy here. And the other thing that this is going to activate is platelets. So remember, platelets have the PAR receptors. There's two of them, and thrombin can cleave those to activate your platelets. So really, you have platelets being activated by both the release of subendothelial collagen at the same time as this extravascular tissue factor. So you're activating your platelets both by subendothelial collagen and by thrombin. And so this is really the first part. This is really initiation, is you generate about 3%-ish, give or take, you know, 3, 2, 3, 4, 5% of the thrombin. And that thrombin, is it going to activate fibrinogen? Could it? Sure. But really, its goal here, and I don't know that thrombin actually has an agenda, but what happens is thrombin activates all of these other guys to really push coagulation. And remember, coagulation is secondary hemostasis. We use the term coag kind of to cover anything hemostasis related, but we're pushing the coag cascade, we're pushing coagulation. But again, it's all happening simultaneously because our platelets here and our platelets here are all being activated. So that's initiation.
And so, like a lot of, so when we get to this is where I love teaching undergrad, and when you get to senior level, we can really get into like the nuance. And so when they first learn coag like a year or two earlier, right, from another class, coag seems to be something of a light switch that's binary. It's off or it's on, right? And at this point of understanding, we can really start talking about what it is. And how I think of it is like that dimmer switch that you have in some of these fancy houses. I don't live in a fancy house, right? But the dimmer switch, it's off, on, and then on some more, right? So there's gradations to the intensity of it. And so this first phase is that click coming out of the off position on the dimmer switch into on. Still pretty dark in that room, right? Once thrombin has activated 5, 8, right? So now that's interesting. It's activating platelets. So now we have activated platelets, which we need for our 10ACE complexes, both the intrinsic and extrinsic. So we have those phospholipid flips. We have those phospholipids to interact with, combined with factor five, so 5 and 10 to form the prothrombinase, factor 8, 9 to form the 10ACE complex. Those now activate their respective targets, 10 and 2, at crazy high magnitudes, like thousands, tens of thousands of times faster. And so now the dimmer switch is getting cranked, right? And that's when we get actual coag. And the mystery to me, when I was in undergrad, and I was so frustrated with this, is like, why is it that patients deficient in factor VIII have such enormous inability to clot? Why are they so hemorrhagic? Because gee whiz, right? We went through tissue factor 7 to 10 to 2, and then 2's activating 1. Like, geez, who needs 8 at all? And this is where the rubber meets the road, is that will that person, factor VIII deficient, eventually form a clot? I suppose. But if you don't do it fast enough, none of it matters, right? None of it matters. So that 3% thrombin generation just isn't going to be enough to form any kind of a stabilized, physiological, useful clot. So anyway, I'll get off the soapbox and let the smart person talk again.
No, that's great. And I think the coag cascade can be very frustrating to memorize, but keeping in mind the application, right? So I always tell students, I don't memorize the coag cascade to be like a party trick. So like, hey, I can write the coag cascade in less than a minute. You want to see? Like, I don't, that's not why you memorize the coag cascade. You memorize it for utilization. So you have this factor VIII deficient patient. Why are they clotting? What assays are going to be abnormal? That sort of thing. That's why you memorize it. Or like, you know, you have a prolonged APTT and a normal PT. Okay, well, it's got to be one of my intrinsic pathway factors and not my common or my extrinsic. Why isn't it the common? Because the PT is normal. And if it was a common pathway factor, the PT would also be abnormal. And when you're dealing with your intrinsic factors, right? We had said it's 8, 9, 11 or 12. All right, what if they're all normal? Now where do you go? So like this is where theory plays a large role in really understanding the theory and understanding how we're using the coag cascade-based model to utilize testing. And we're utilizing the cell-based model slightly differently. It's what's actually happening in vivo. So that's why sometimes you'll look at your APTT, like if you have a factor 12 deficiency and your APTT is going to be super prolonged and you're going to be like, oh my gosh, but the patient's not bleeding. They have no bleeding problems. And it's because factor 12 doesn't actually physiologically play a major role. So this is where it comes back to understanding the cell-based model versus the coag cascade-based model. So you know the cascade-based model is more testing in vitro and the cell-based model is more physiological or in vivo.
So now these are two different tools that you have in your toolbox, right? Are you interpreting testing? You're going to use the coag cascade. Are you interpreting physiological effect, right? Looking at how it affects the person day to day and physiologically, you use the cell-based model to think about that. Cool. I love talking about this stuff.
All right, so let's go to the coag cascade-based model. Let me pull that. I was gonna say pull it up. Let me draw it out for you really quick here. This way I can kind of give you the lowdown on how to think about the cell-based model on the cascade-based model. So Dave, I don't know if you wanna fill in the time or if you want me to talk
I'd
about
love
it
to.
as I do it.
No, that'd be kind of tricky. But yeah, just going back to what I said about the tools, just It is totally possible for you to, I think you can be a really good functional tech and not know the cell-based model. I really do genuinely believe that. But if you're someone who's looking for that deeper level of understanding, so in truth, like Melissa can attest to this, I'm probably one of the laziest people walking planet Earth. And what I end up doing is I put in a lot of work to understand things at a very granular detail so I could be lazy later. So I'm like a proactive lazy person. So the more you master these things, I think the easier it is to apply it in like real world scenarios, right? But yeah, having this level of thinking at the bench can be really, really helpful. So I hope even like our working techs that might watch this and maybe be brushing up, can find a lot of utility in it. Yeah. So yeah.
No.
That's about all the air I ran out of air.
That's all right. So I'm just scribbling out the coag. I'm doing my party trick. I'm scribbling out the coag cascade here. And it's so that we can go through and look at how we can apply what's happening in vivo to this. And I've got another analogy for you to think about it. And then we'll move into fibrinolysis.
Everybody
Okay, so
forgets tertiary hemostasis.
yeah, tertiary. Okay, so that's because they look at secondary and they're like, me. And then they gotta, they're like, no, no more, no more.
It really is the hardest part of coag, bro, right? I think. So for me, the tertiary stuff is and the coag controls are like that's tricky. Yeah.
So
Probably.
let's think about, this is obviously the coag cascade based model, and we're thinking about what's happening in vivo. So again, it all comes back to thrombin. Oh, I'm putting my pen in the wrong place. There you go. It all comes back to thrombin. So if you think about thrombin coming back and activating all of the different players that it needs to activate, I guess I'll come over here so that it can activate. Right. So it going off and activating protein C and platelets. Right. In this model, we don't really think about it all happening simultaneously, although it does. Remember, platelets and coag all simultaneously, which allows you to really weave that clot into the platelet clump as it forms. But let's just focus on the coag cascade-based model. So what happens in vivo, right? Because remember, we have the PT. Over here, the extrinsic pathway is the PT. And remember, I always memorized it as PTX. And then over here, you've got a ton of coag factors and you got a much longer name, the APTT. So, with your what's happening in vivo, you have tissue factor binding with activated factor seven coming down, activating factor 10 to get. Our prothrombin activating into thrombin, and then thrombin comes back and activates everybody. But remember, TFPI, tissue factor pathway inhibitor, very quickly and rapidly inhibits the extrinsic pathway, activated factor seven when it's complex with tissue factor. So we're quickly shutting that off, which leaves you with the intrinsic pathway, which we've already activated. Because remember, activated factor seven can come over here and activate factor nine with tissue factor. And then you also have thrombin coming back and activating 11, which is pushing our intrinsic pathway. So we're activating the intrinsic pathway, right? And then we're creating our clot. So you could think about this in the way that you light like a campfire. So in order to light a campfire, you first need to have some source of fuel, right? You need to have wood or something, right? And that's all of our coag factors. But if you just have wood sitting there, they're not going to do anything. So you need to have some kind of ignition source. So you light the match. So your tissue factor is that ignition source that's lighting the match. And you light the process here, right? So maybe you throw some kindling on and then you throw your flame in. And here's your flame, you throw it in and you go through the process. But your match is this big. It's teeny tiny. So your match is going to go out really quickly and you're no longer going to have the match. But if you have the fuel there, you're going to light the fire and you're going to have a big, huge campfire going. And what keeps your campfire going is that fuel, right? And which is really the intrinsic to the common pathway. So in vivo, what's actually happening is you use the extrinsic pathway to very rapidly turn on the campfire or start the campfire, but you actually keep the campfire going with the intrinsic and the common pathway. So that's
I
a
think,
way to apply the cell-based model onto the cascade-based model.
the intrinsic 10ase is extremely powerful. So they're both 10ases, the extrinsic 10ase and the intrinsic, both 10ases technically, but way different strengths, right? So, yeah. Great analogy.
Okay.
A fire, I actually was thinking about like, I don't know. It just kind of lends itself to this reaction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we're clotting, right? So again, your PTE, your
Yeah.
APTT, they're both going to end at fibrin monomers because we're just looking at clot formation. We're not looking at how is your clot actually staying clotted? Is it a strong clot? We're not looking at any of that. So your PT and APTT are going to end here. They're not going to look at factor 13 activated and whether it's functioning or not. But that's a different time, right? A different story for a different
I
time when
mean,
we
it
actually
is.
talk about assays. I think the last thing we have to talk about is fibrinolysis, so breaking up the clots and then getting rid of all that stuff.
Yeah, so physiologically, forming a clot
Oops.
is a very important process. And then as you heal, we don't need the clot anymore. And a clot that sticks around when it's not needed can actually be pathophysiological, right? So we definitely encounter patients that are able to form a clot, and then perhaps maybe they're inappropriately forming clots in the form of thromboses that then become dangerous. So having a way to get rid of it is just as important as having a way to form it. So fibrinolysis is there's a lot of different players here, right? So and then we have control proteins for the. I just started thinking ahead, and I was like, "Oh my God!" It's
Calm, no, breathe. There's really, what do you think of fibrinolysis? There's one major player, right?
plasmin, right?
That's
Yeah.
plasmin. And so we need to get plasmin. So we start with plasminogen. And we'll
And this is a
eventually.
really cool molecule, actually,
Yeah.
right? So plasminogen actually begins the story in clot formation. So if you imagine our spaghetti strands, now once you see them on a smear, they're never not going to be spaghetti strands to me,
Like
right?
this.
Yep. So we have our fibrin monomers forming this polymer via 13 and this cross-linking and stuff. And weaved within our spaghetti strands is this molecule plasminogen. And I always kind of think of it as like sticks of dynamite, like in like a wall, right? And so we can plant this dynamite in the formation of the clot, but not light the fuse on the dynamite yet. So
And
eventually, right?
for those of you that actually enjoy the biochemistry, which it's probably like me and the other clotter nerds, it's when you cleave fibrinogen into fibrin, you expose lysine moieties. Just so these lysine groups on top of the fibrin molecule. Dave's like, I'm gone. I'm not enjoying this. And those lysine moieties are what the kringles that are found, and they're basically these loop formations on the plasminogen. They're attracted to the lysine moieties. And so that's what plasminogen goes in, and its little kringles will bind and be attracted to the lysine moieties on the fibrin.
Am I the only one who thought of potato chips just now? I don't know.
Because I said kringles. I said kringles with a K, not pringles with a P, Dave.
I'm just hungry.
So yeah, either way, whether you think about it as sticks of dynamite or you, which is a great analogy, or if you want to think about it as, you know, the biochemistry, whatever floats your boat, we've got both for you here.
Yeah, so now how do we get from plasminogen to plasmin,
Well, we're
right?
gonna need our friend to activate plasminogen. TPA. tissue, plasminogen activator. There's also urokinase, UPA. It's just going to come from different sources, right? So TPA can come from our endothelial cells, whereas UPA is going to come more from our endothelial cells found in the urinary area, so the kidney. So just similar, structurally similar molecules,
Yeah.
but slight
So they can
differences.
kind of do the same thing, right? I can have scissors that look a little bit different, but they can still do the scissor thing, right? So
Yes.
the way I think about that. But TPA is like our, we can focus on
He's the
TPA.
main player. Yeah.
And so this is what I love about who all the folks that came before us that like all the scientists that spent this time to figure all these things out. Thank you for naming these things in a way that represents their function.
Well, thank you for naming this in a way that represents their
Fair
function.
enough.
Not
Fair
thank you
enough.
for labeling factor seven as stable factor when it's got the shortest half-life.
Fair enough. That's okay. So some of you shakes fists, but some of you not. So yeah, TPA, very important. And we'll see. Really, I shouldn't do this, but I do it all the time. We can use this as a therapeutic as well. So we have synthetic forms of TPA. And use your imagination. We're not there yet, but maybe use your imagination. How might you use something like that? In what physiological state would you use TPA? Anyway, so.
Yeah, so synthetic TPAs, UPAs, streptokinases, things like that to help break up clots.
Break clots that are bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got plasminogen. So w like Dave said, think about plasminogen as like sticking sticks of dynamite into the clot as it's forming, but not lighting them up. Or they're weaving themselves into the clot because they're attracted to some of the different areas of the fibrin molecules. So essentially, that's what plasminogen's doing. But then plasminogen is just going to sit there and chill. So if you never activate plasminogen, it's not going to do anything. It's a zymogen, right? Zymogens don't do anything. You have to activate them. You have to cleave them to activate them into their active form, which is plasmin. So if we activate plasminogen into plasmin, then plasmin can go through the process of breaking up our clot. Plasminogen is just that creep that's going to sit there and not move and hang out next to fibrinogen because it's attracted, but it can't do anything, kind of thing. So plasminogen is just going to chill. Once you activate it with TPA into plasmin, that's when it's going to start breaking up the clot. So let me, in my fantastic drawing abilities, show you a clot formation, right? So remember, this is our fibrin molecule, our fibrin monomer. We have a D domain and an E domain and another D domain. And we've cleaved off those little fibrinopeptide antlers that were on there. So now we've just got this molecule. And that's what happens when you cleave those little antlers off, you expose lysine moieties over here. So as what's happening here is, remember, factor 13 activated is creating covalent bonds in between our fibrin monomers to give us a fibrin polymer. So I'm just gonna draw in lots of fibrin molecules.
Thank you for doing the two levels too, because I think it's helpful to see that they like stagger sort of on top of each other.
Yeah, so to see how they're staggered a little bit, and you get covalent bonds like this. These little dots are my covalent bonds. I know they're not great, but they are covalent bonds, right? So you have these little bonds forming. And so all of your molecules are bound to one another covalently to give you a polymer. So this is your fibrin polymer. So remember when we did the coag cascade? I think I actually left it up there. Yep, we drew from a fibrin monomer to a fibrin polymer. And so factor 13 activated, it's a factor 13 is a transglutaminase. So all it's doing is moving a glutamine group around. And so we're getting a monomer to a polymer. So now we're at a point where our fibrin molecules can actually covalently bind to one another because you've moved that molecule around. So here we are. And then you've got this excellent molecule here known as plasminogen binding to those exposed lysine moieties Right? Or it's basically like Dave said, I know I kind of it almost looks like sperm the way I drew them, but think of them more like dynamite sticks though that are going to be stuck into this clot that's formed. And so once we activate plasminogen into plasmin, now we're going to go through the process of going hi-yah, 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 hi-yah.
Sleeves. Yep.
We're going to cut up that clot that forms. So that
Thank you,
is,
Paul. You did your job.
yeah.
Bye-bye.
So that is that process. Now, when you break up the clot, you're going to get little pieces left over of fibrinogen, or excuse me, fibrin. Be fibrinogen, depending on the pieces that you're talking about. And if you read in your textbook, they're going to tell you that it's X, Y, D, and E are the pieces that are left over. I don't know why they have to call it pieces X and Y when it's just really pieces of this, but we'll get there. So you have your X pieces, which are essentially your D and E fragments, or your E and D fragments. So you take your fibrin molecule. Right, here we go. We've got fibrin, you've got a D, you got an E, you got a D. And if you've cleaved here, you got an X piece and a little D piece left over. If you have the full piece, the DED, that's what a Y is. And then, of course, you have the D and the E, right? So that's self-explanatory, a D piece and an E piece. Now, the other piece that you also get when you break down your clot is a D-dimer, which are two piece D pieces that are bound together. Now, take a look at fibrin. Let me erase this line here going through. Just take a look at fibrin. So if you look at fibrin itself, when you break, if you break down fibrin all on its own, you could get a DE piece, right? You could get an ED piece. You could get a D piece. You could get an E piece. All of these pieces are perfectly capable of being found if you're just breaking down fibrin, or if you're even if you're breaking down fibrinogen. But this DD piece, do you can you naturally find D and D covalently bound together, circulating? If coagulation has not occurred, right? So coagulation has to occur in order to get two D domains bound together.
That's why the D-dimer assay is so integral to interpreting physiological status, right? This directly correlates to the fact that there was coagulation that took place and fibrinolysis took place. Like, you know, this is the only way chemically for this to happen, right?
Yes.
Beautiful. Because they used to be, so there are different, so when we look at our XYDE and then the D-dimer, those all could be said to be fibrin split products, right? Or fibrin
SPs
degradation
or
products.
FDPs, yep.
So yeah, so we hear these terms, right? And the D-dimer is just an ultra-specific molecule that is of those things, but
Yes.
can only exist if there was a cross-linking, if there was that polymerization of fibrin that took place. So that's why this test is so darn important. Pretty cool.
Yes. And that's why, excuse me, your FSPs, FDPs are not quite as specific because if you have plasmin at all activated, it can break down fibrin or fibrinogen.
Yep, circulating fibrinogen will get cleaved all the same, right? If circulating plasmin encounters it.
Yep. But your DD is very specific. So the D-dimer assay has a fantastic negative predictive value because if your D-dimers are not there, then coagulation and fibrinolysis did not occur.
Yep, very unlikely that there's thrombosis, right?
Now, if
Yeah.
it's positive, what does that mean? But it has that great negative predictive value, so we can tell if someone has clots forming or not. Now, this is not saying that D-dimers being positive does not mean that clots are forming abnormally. It
Right.
could be that
Right.
someone, you know, had surgery or something, and then clots should be forming and being broken down.
Yeah, and just to add emphasis to what Melissa is saying here, right? So if a clinical team is trying to rule out the possibility of thromboses, the D-dimer is wonderful in that, right? If there is thrombosis, D-dimer will be positive, right?
Yes.
So to that extent, it negative, it, th that's what makes it that negative predictor, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome. Super cool. Thank you for your drawings. I appreciate them.
You're welcome. They're not beautiful,
They're
but they
wonderful.
do.
No. All jokes aside, they're wonderful. Like, this is great. Thank you. Yeah.
Some kind of visual is better than no visual with this.
Absolutely.
So I
Cool.
think that's all normal. And we can definitely start thinking about how to apply it all abnormally. Actually, I mean, we didn't hit on any of the control proteins for fibrinolysis.
So we could talk a little bit about them, right?
Let's
So like,
hit them briefly, yeah.
yeah, so like one might say like, yikes, so say I form a clot in my toe, and then I form a clot in my finger. I don't, but then my toe heals first. So I got activated plasmin. I don't want plasmin dissolving the clot in my finger yet. My finger's still healing, right? So there's, we got a control protein for that. So we literally, the control protein for plasmin is called antiplasmin. And so antiplasmin is
Oops.
really cool, circulating. And the combination, the how the all these things exist together ends up resulting in what we see is like, antiplasmin serves as this global control to prevent plasmin from perhaps dissociating once a clot is dissolved and causing havoc elsewhere. It will be picked up by an antiplasmin and then turned off as to not affect you know, a clot that might be somewhere else. So what we have, as we get a deeper understanding here, and we're going to probably come back to this, a lot of what happens in normal physiology localizes this activity, which is wonderful. I want clotting to happen here, not
Yes.
there. I want dissolving of the clot to happen here, not there. And so antiplasmin is our is one of our go-to molecules for sure.
Yeah, the other major molecule is PAI, PAI1 or 2, which is plasminogen activator inhibitor. And that inhibits TPA.
It's kind of like those Russian nesting dolls of like terms. They start to like get really convoluted.
Yes. But so I just call them PAI, PAI, PAI. And PAI is really important. It's actually so important that it's released from endothelial cells at the same time as TPA and in significantly greater amounts. And that's because we want TPA to absolutely stay local. You can't, it's like allowing fibrin monomers to like escape the area. It's similarly where you do not want thrombin, fibrin monomers, or TPA to escape the area. You want them to stay regulated to the site of clot formation. Otherwise, you can get inappropriate clotting, bleeding, the whole process. So PAI 1 and 2 is one of the other really important control proteins that we have in fibrinolysis. I think those are the two big ones. There's a couple other minor ones too, but those are the bigger ones.
I think that our audience could survive on those too.
Yeah.
And they also by themselves give you the big picture,
Yes.
like this makes sense, right? So
Yes. And
cool.
so that's the big thing is regulating. And then you can imagine what happens when you don't regulate.
Right. So as we talk about the pathophysiology of this, of which like COAG is incredibly deep, it's very, very deep. We can see that deficiencies in procoagulant or anticoagulant or control proteins, right, can just kind of wreak havoc on the normal physiology. Cool.
So that's for this one, we'll just end with normal. And then future ones, we'll start hitting on different disease processes and, of course, further laboratory testing. So I think that's all we have for this one. So thanks for listening.
Thank you for your time.